Good evening. Prince Andrew doesn't remember his alleged sex parties with Jeffrey Epstein, a peace activist in Bolivia, and the arguments for DACA. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the news for Saturday, November 16th, 2019. Mark Sandy, a career official of the Office of Management and Budget, testified on Saturday about the holdup of military aid to Ukraine in a closed-door session of the Trump impeachment inquiry. Public hearings are set to resume next week. Sandy is the first person from OMB to testify before the inquiry after three political appointees defied congressional subpoenas to appear. The OMB official complied with a subpoena issued to compel his testimony. Also on Saturday, the House Intelligence Committee released transcripts of depositions from former National Security Council official Tim Morrison and Jennifer Williams, an aide to Vice President Mike Pence. A member of the committee said Sandy was brought in to shed light on whether military aid was held up for political reasons. Although Friday's public testimony by former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Ivanovich, garnered headlines, a closed-door session with embassy official David Holmes may be more useful to investigators. Holmes says he overheard a call between Trump and Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, about Ukraine's willingness to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden's son, Hunter, who sat on the board of a Ukrainian energy company. Holmes ties Trump more directly to pressure on Ukraine to go after Biden by Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. House leaders say they're considering bringing Holmes in for a public hearing. And Britain's Prince Andrew says he doesn't remember meeting an American woman who alleges she was forced to have sex with him when she was underage. Andrew also told BBC television he had let the side down by staying with U.S. financier Jeffrey Epstein after Epstein's conviction for paying a teenage girl for sex.
One of Epstein's accusers, Virginia Roberts, yeah, has made allegations against you. She says she met you in 2001. She says she dined with you, danced with you at Tramp nightclub in London. She went on to have sex with you in a house in Belgravia belonging to Ghislaine Maxwell, your friend. Your response?
I have no recollection of ever meeting this lady. None whatsoever.
You don't remember meeting her?
No.
But you were staying at the house of, yes, a convicted sex offender?
It was a convenient place to stay. I've gone through this in my mind so many times. At the end of the day, with the benefit of all the hindsight that one could have, it was definitely the wrong thing to do. But at the time, I felt it was the honourable and right thing to do, and I admit fully that my judgment was probably coloured by my tendency to be too honourable. But that's just the way it is.
And that's Prince Andrew being interviewed by the BBC. The entire interview will be released sometime this weekend. One of Epstein's accusers, Virginia Jeffrey, has said she was forced to have sex with Andrew in London, New York, and on a private Caribbean island where she says Epstein kept her as a, quote, sex slave. Jeffrey, previously named Virginia Roberts, says she first had sex with Andrew when she was 17. Gloria Allred, a lawyer acting for alleged victims of Epstein, says Andrew should answer questions under oath. And I've been in touch with Gloria Allred, and we'll be doing an interview later this weekend, which will probably run on WBAI next week. And Bolivia's political crisis turned deadly again when security forces opened fire on supporters of Evo Morales. Officials said Saturday that at least eight people died and dozens were injured in an incident that threatens the interim government's efforts to restore stability following the resignation of the former president in an election dispute. Most of the dead and injured Friday in Sacaba, near the city of Cochabamba, had been shot. Reportedly, angry demonstrators and relatives of the victims gathered at the site of the shootings, chanting "Civil War Now." Morales, who was granted asylum in Mexico after his November 10th resignation, said on Twitter that a massacre had occurred, and he described the interim government led by Jeanine Añez as a dictatorship. At least 13 other people had died during weeks of earlier protests against Morales before his departure. Morales stepped down following nationwide protests over suspected vote rigging in an October 20th election in which he claimed to have won a fourth term in office. Morales has denied there was fraud. Peace activist Medea Benjamin of Code Pink arrived in La Paz, Bolivia earlier today to offer support to Bolivia's people.
I'm in Bolivia to be an observer about what's happening here, the attacks on peaceful protesters, the coup d'etat, and to relay the information back to people at home.
How long have you been there now?
I just got here today.
What have you seen in your time there?
We have spoken to a number of people, gone down to the marketplace, see a very, very divided society. The indigenous people in the marketplace, who are the main people who are selling things, are very upset about Evo Morales being gone. They said during his time of 14 years in power that he made things much better for them, that their lives had improved tremendously, that they had better standard of living, houses to live in, and that now that this right-wing racist group is in power, they won't stand for it, and they're going to be protesting and demanding that Evo Morales come back. The white folks in the in market were saying just the opposite, that Evo Morales is a dictator, that this was a fraudulent election, and that he's never coming back. We also saw right-wing evangelicals who were going from police barricade to police barricade, praying with the police. There's a very strong evangelical element that's part of this right-wing group that took over. And the barricades are up in every place going towards the government offices, but the big demonstrations will start up again here on Monday. Meanwhile, in Cochabamba, yesterday there was a terrible massacre in which 9 people were killed and over 100 wounded. But on the television, which is now taken over by the right wing, they're portraying it as if these were armed people, and they're showing all these, quote, weapons that the people who were hurt and killed were had on them. And the folks who are more sympathetic to Evo Morales said that all of the television is now right-wing propaganda. They don't believe anything that's being transmitted to them, and the same for the print media. So very, very divided society.
And did you see any signs of the repression we've been reading about, the repression of the protests and things like that? Have you seen any examples yourself of that?
Well, we just got here today, and as I said, today is a day where the folks who are against the right-wing government are just getting their forces back together to be able to come out on Monday.
You mentioned barricades, though, a moment ago. You said the evangelicals were going from barricade to barricade. Do you see barricades and things like that in the streets?
Yes, there's barricades all around the main downtown area where the presidential palace is, where the branches of the Congress are, where all the government offices are. We were not able to get through. We tried through several different entrances. So that's all barricaded up, and there's a lot of police in the street.
Those are police barricades. Those are police barricades, not barricades of the people. Are there any examples of the people resisting, like their own barricades or anything like that?
Yes, there are barricades that the people have put up on the outskirts of the city. We flew into the airport in La Paz, but it's outside. It's in a place called El Alto. And there are barricades that the people have set up. So we had to go and take a circuitous route to be able to get into La Paz because of the different barricades that have been set up. There's also a lot of shortages in the markets because food is not coming in. People are complaining that the prices in the last 2 weeks have doubled and that they can't get chicken, they can't get meat. In some of the poor restaurants where the Bolivian people eat, they were just having potatoes and rice and a little bit of canned sardines. So people are hurting. And the other thing is that the new Minister of Communications came out and really threatened the journalists who are reporting on the truth of what's going on here. And so we met journalists in the streets from different international organizations like France 24 who feel that they are being set up by the government to be attacked by people, the more of the pro-right-wing people who say, you foreigners are not telling the truth, you foreigners are not saying that Evo Morales was a dictator. You are pretending this was a coup d'etat. It's not. It was fraud on the part of Evo Morales and his party called MAS. So there's a lot of threatening of journalists, and the journalists who are here are quite afraid. And many of the political people are in hiding right now because they fear for their lives as well.
And what do you expect will happen? And how long are you going to be there? And what do you expect to happen while you're there?
We're going to be here for a week. We were just called by somebody in Cochabamba that they want more foreigners to go there and look into the massacre that happened and the lies that the government is putting out about how these people were killed. According to our friends there, all the interviews they did, they said these people were not armed. They don't have weapons. But the government is pretending or saying that people were armed. So we hope to go and check out that situation.
Great. Can we have a report when you're down there? Can we have a report from you when you're down there?
Yes, we'd love to do that.
All right, great. When do you expect to be down there?
We'd love to do that.
When do you expect to be down there, do you think?
In 2 days.
Okay, we'll try you maybe Monday. I'll call it Tuesday. That said, great. Can I ask you one more question? I had an interview with Max Blumenthal, and he said about a terrible thing that happened to him related to his stay at the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., or the consulate there. And then I heard there were reports that you were hassled in the same way. Is that true?
Yes, there were five police cars that came screeching up to my house, as well as police on motorcycles and bicycles, like I was some terrorist. They came to arrest me. They accused me of having assaulted a congresswoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, at a press conference where I was the one who was attacked and thrown to the ground and choked. And I asked them where their warrant was. They didn't have a warrant. And after some time, they said the detectives were looking over the footage. Now, you think they would have done that before they put out an all-points bulletin to come to my house? And in the end, I suppose they realized that I had never attacked a congresswoman, and they left. But like Max, who was now accused 5 months later, I am worried that they could come back with a warrant sometime.
Do you think they're related because you both were down there at the embassy?
Absolutely. These are the very same people. I mean, they were holding a press conference with the same Venezuelans, the same ones who attacked us every day when we were at the embassy, hitting us, shoving us, spitting on us. And every time we asked the police to arrest them for attacking us, they didn't. And even at this press conference that happened a few days ago, there were six of us. They tore the signs out of our hands. They even tore the phone out of somebody's hand. And when we went to the police and said, do something about it, the police wouldn't do anything. So the D.C. police, the Metropolitan Police, and the Secret Service are all working with the Venezuelan opposition against us, the nonviolent, peaceful demonstrators, who are trying to uphold international law and the principle of non-intervention.
I see. Very good. Is this worse? You think it's getting worse? I mean, you've been activist a long time. Do you feel getting worse, or is this usually how it goes?
Oh, no, this is worse for us. I mean, this is certainly not worse for people like in the black community who are constantly attacked for things they never did. But for us, this is definitely worse, and I have never seen all the different security agencies working against us so overtly and so obviously in the pocket of these right-wing groups. And I must say that this is because both Democrats and Republicans, for the most part, support the Venezuelan elite, just like they support the Cuban right wing. And this is not because they care about the people in Venezuela or Cuba. If they did, they would lift the sanctions. It's because they care about the votes in Florida, and there are about 200,000 right-wing Cubans and Venezuelans. And the Democrats and Republicans are vying for their votes in a very critical state of Florida.
Great. Anything you'd like to add?
It's unfortunate that the U.S. news is so consumed about the impeachment that it's not covering anything that's happening. And this coup d'etat in Bolivia is a very, very critical one that will determine the future of this country for many years to come. And it's important we speak out against it, and that we push our elected officials to speak out against it, and the Democratic candidates. Bernie Sanders as far as I know, is the only one so far that has really come out against this coup, but the others should be pressured to do that as well.
And Medea Benjamin is a peace activist associated with Code Pink. She arrived in La Paz, Bolivia earlier today to offer support to Bolivia's people. She spoke with WBAI. In another in added news, in an exclusive interview with WBAI, journalist Max Blumenthal had described an October 25th raid by a D.C. SWAT team who arrested him on unspecified charges of simple assault. Blumenthal says the arrest was related to his coverage of the Embassy Protectors, a group that prevented supporters of Juan Guaido, the U.S.-supported politician who claims to be president of Venezuela after a crackdown on the elected government of the nation by the Trump administration. He's free on bail and will be in court later this month. And in another South American hotspot, rights watchdogs say public prosecutors in Chile are investigating thousands of cases of alleged abuses, ranging from torture to sexual violence by security forces during weeks of anti-government unrest. Even more victims could be afraid to report abuse amid the toughest crackdown since Augusto Pinochet's military dictatorship ended in 1990. The allegations of police brutality have put pressure on center-right President Sebastián Piñera, who acknowledges abuses by police. Many protesters have been blinded by rubber bullets and tear gas canisters, according to medics. Patricio Acosta, president of Red Cross Chile, said more people lost an eye in the past 3 weeks than in the last 20 years. The Chilean Ophthalmological Society has registered 225 instances of severe eye trauma from October 19th to November 10th and says that may rise. In one case, a young protester named Miranda was hit by 6 rubber bullets. She says 4 of them piercing her skin. As blood streamed down her legs, she grabbed a fence to hold herself up, and police sprayed her in the face with tear gas. Convalescing at a friend's home, Miranda said she would march again. "We don't mind being hungry, facing hardship, neglect, pain," she said. "People are willing to make a sacrifice to achieve real change." And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York, listener-sponsored, independent, and locally produced radio. I'm Paul DiRienzo. On November 12th, the United States Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case of Department of Homeland Security versus Regents of the University of California and another case brought by the NAACP on the legality of the Trump administration's order overturning President Obama's order giving protection to undocumented immigrants who have spent their entire lives in the United States. DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, covers more than 600,000 people who could face deportation. In this excerpt of the 90-minute-long hearing, attorney Theodore Olson, who represents DACA supporters, debates conservative Trump appointees Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh on whether the memo by Homeland Security Secretary Christian Nielsen, saying the government had no choice because Obama's order was illegal, is wrong and should be, and that judicial intervention should be allowed.
This is a reversal of a policy that the government created that triggered, to use the words of this court, engendered reliance interests. And all we're saying is that it should be subject to review in the context of this big picture. It isn't say that every decision by a prosecutor that I'm going to now enforce murder cases or kidnapping cases or child porn case or serious drug cases, doesn't cause individuals to come forward to participate in a program, to make decisions. Businesses, health, educational institutions, the armed forces, all are making decisions based upon this. No one was saying that the policy can't be changed. But when the policy does, if the government wishes to change a broad policy like this, which affects so many people in so many serious ways.
Well, if I might ask a question about that, if we're talking about the merits, then, and then I'll pass off the baton. The reliance interests that we've talked about earlier, I think your friend on the other side would say we did address reliance interests in a paragraph, and we could do it in 15 pages, but we'd say pretty much the same thing at the end of the day, and it'd take another 6 years, and it would leave this class of persons under a continuing cloud of uncertainty and continue stasis in the political branches, because they would not have a baseline rule of decision from this court still on this issue.
It's what this court has said.
What do you say to that? And that's the line of argument, as I understand it, from the government.
Yes, I know it is. And the government's saying all we needed was a few more words. That is not what this court has said with respect to administrative review of judicial review of administrative decisions. You must have a rational explanation. It must make sense. It must be contemporaneous. I will get to the Nielsen memorandum, which was not contemporaneous. It was not a new decision.
I understand that. If you could just address it, though, on the merits. Why was that insufficient, I think, is one of the questions. And the other is, what good would another 5 years of litigation over the adequacy of that explanation serve?
We don't know what the administration would do. The administration did not want to own this decision. When the Attorney General decided that this, I'm making this decision because the
doctor, I guess I'm asking about the reliance interests question.
I'm trying to get to that. I wish
you would.
Well, the reliance interests were triggered, to use the words of this court, in the Fox case, the LTV case, and various other cases. Those reliance interests were engendered by the decision by the government that caused people to come forward.
I understand that. The question is, what more would you have the government say about those reliance interests? If it's a failure of adequacy of explaining, what more is left to be said?
What they could have said is that we understand all of these people working for all these people. We understand what people are going through. Provide a reasoned, rational explanation, to use the words of this court just a few months ago in the census case, to explain those things, to explain why a policy is being changed, and make a contemporaneous decision. The Nielsen memorandum came along 9 months later. It was based upon a different individual.
But
it didn't have an administrative record.
Assuming, well, go ahead and finish.
Well, it'll take another sentence or two, but there are a lot of things wrong. The Nielsen memorandum was not an independent decision. She was bound, just as the earlier acting administrator, was, because the Attorney General said this is illegal.
But the Nielsen memo then goes on to say, as you heard Mr. Francisco say to my question, that regardless of whether these concerns about the DACA policy rendered illegal or legally questionable, there are sound reasons of enforcement policy to rescind the DACA policy, and then goes on to explain the policy rationales to rescind it. So what is your response to Mr. Francis?
In the first place, they were not independent. They were not contemporaneous. They were not accompanied by an administrative record.
She says they're independent in that sense.
She says they're independent.
At least that's what Mr. Francisco says.
Mr. Francisco said that, and she said that, but they weren't independent because she was bound by the Attorney General's decision. And the government itself, in its brief that I quoted a moment ago, said DACA was unlawful, thus we had to terminate it. Now, and it's not contemporaneous, and then the policy decisions are saying, we understand people may have relied on this, but that's just too bad. That's basically all it was. There were not, the litigation risk issue is like a rubber stamp that the agencies can put on anything. Every decision an agency makes could involve.
Do you agree that the executive has the legal authority to rescind DACA?
Yes.
Okay. So the question then comes down to the explanation, and if it's the Nielsen memo paragraph on reliance that it comes down to, so which is the last.
It was not explained.
Can I just ask the question in this way, which is assume the Nielsen memo comes in and assume it comes down to whether the Nielsen memo adequately explained the reliance interests. What was the shortfall in the Nielsen memo in addressing reliance interests? Because she does acknowledge that a lot of people have relied. She does it briefly.
Yeah, she says just too bad. People relied, so too bad. Too bad about that. Camp versus Pitts specifically says when an explanation for an agency decision is given, however curt, they must stand or fall on that explanation.
Do you think you could explain the reliance or the justifications for the policy in a way that would overcome the reliance interests?
They would, yes, I believe that that's possible. They could have, an analysis of costs and benefits, explaining why an OLC decision is being thrown out the window, why a policy is being changed that the administration is being for. That's exactly what you have said.
Mr. Olson, can I go back to something Justice Gorsuch asked, which is, what's the benefit of delaying this further? It has been, at least looking at the deferred action decisions, the dozens that have gone on through the decades, Congress has responded, sometimes changing the policy, sometimes limiting it, sometimes expanding it. It has responded. But the dynamic is very different, isn't it, when a executive says, I don't have the power, and when it says, even if I had the power, I choose not to do this. Aren't the dynamics of what happens between Congress and the president dramatically different in those circumstances?
Exactly. This is what is called virtual reality. When it says, I don't have the power to do it, but if I did in the sky, I might have done it for this reason. The answer, the short answer to your question, Justice Sotomayor, is a very good one. Someone say, I might have done it if I'd had the power to do it, but I have no discretion, I have no power to do it. We don't know what the administration would do if it had to make this decision and take ownership and accountability of this decision.
That's your point about given the Attorney General decision and the law that says they have to change it. That's a very different circumstance than saying, even if I don't have to, I won't.
That's exactly right. The administration would then have to explain, we want to take responsibility for throwing these people out of work, removing people that came here when they were maybe 2 years old, who have not committed a crime, and who have volunteered for this program, have conducted themselves properly,
Mr. Olson,
and so forth.
I understand that litany. but do you seriously want to argue that if this case were to go back and the agency were to say again exactly what General Francisco interprets the Nielsen memo as saying, giving all of these reasons and saying that each one is an independently sufficient basis for the action, would that be unlawful? And let's say they go into great length in explaining every factor, every basis.
Certainly. If they explained and provided a rational explanation instead of just pushing a button or putting a rubber stamp on it, that's what judicial review is all about. That means the agency would have taken responsibility for making the consequences of those decisions, explaining why it thought about it and why it decided what it do. That's what your decisions require by judicial review.
Thank you, counsel.
An excerpt from arguments before the United States Supreme Court on the legality of Trump's order ending DACA protection for hundreds of thousands of undocumented people in the United States. Attorney Theodore Olson defending DACA was questioned by Trump appointees Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, and you also heard Justice Sotomayor in that exchange as well. And finally, President Donald Trump spent more than 2 hours at Walter Reed National Medical Center on Saturday for what the White House said were medical tests as part of his annual physical. The appointment wasn't on Trump's weekend public schedule, and his last physical was in February. Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham said the 73-year-old president was anticipating a very busy 2020 and wanted to take advantage of a free weekend in Washington to begin portions of his routine checkup. She was not more specific about the testing. Trump's 2018 and 2019 physicals were announced in advance and appeared on his public schedule. The February checkup showed he had put on some pounds and was now officially considered obese. His body mass index was 30.4. His weight was 243 pounds, and he was 6 feet 3 inches tall. Trump spent more than 4 hours at Walter Reed on February 8th for his most recent checkup, supervised by Dr. Sean P. Connolly, his physician, and involving a panel of 11 specialists. And that's some of the news for Saturday, November 16, 2019. The news was engineered by James Irsay. From the studios of the WBAI, listener-sponsored, independent, and locally produced news, I'm Paul DiRienzo.
Coming up,
up next on the half hour, we have the Laura Flanders Show.